Today's episode is brought to you by Essex Realty Group and Appeal.Tax. So use Essex to buy a multifamily building, then appeal those taxes.
So we're moving from slow-moving debacle to a slow-moving evolution where there's still going to be a little bit of a debacle aspect, but not the meltdown that many people had predicted, including myself.
Welcome to the only podcast to specifically focus on real estate investing in and around the great city we call Chicago. With a focus on neighborhoods, strategies, success stories, obstacles, resources needed, and everything you need to know from everyone that has done it before you. We break down what has worked and, more importantly, what has not. We want you to learn best practices and pitfalls to avoid in your real estate investments here in Chicago so you can become a straight up Chicago investor. Here are your property manager and investor hosts, Mark Ainley and Tom Shalecross.
Welcome to another episode of the Straight Up Chicago Investor Podcast. I'm Tom Shalecross. With me, as always, is Mark Ainley. Mark, it's just about December when we're recording this. How are we doing? Are you ready for the holidays?
I'm feeling excited about holidays. I actually was feeling so excited today. I almost asked if I could do the intro, the bringing us into the show, but I chickened out at the last minute. I'm like, I'll mess it up. So no, feeling good, man. I think this time of year, you have everyone's just that much happier. Everyone's kind of in the giving spirit and appreciating things a little more. It's coming out of Thanksgiving into December month of all the holidays. It's good right now. Things are supposed to be slower for your businesses. So you're supposed to be focusing on growth or the people around you, your team, building them and appreciating them and seeing your team going into the new year. So what about you? What are you doing for your team for the holidays to appreciate them?
Valid point on all accounts. I would just say this is going to air probably really close to Christmas. If you didn't give gifts, do it, right? And not just the here's a gift card to whatever, like, go ahead and be creative, be personal, right? A restaurant they mentioned in passing, something for their kids, something for their spouse, like show that you listen and that you give a damn. Like that's the stuff that gets remembered. It's not the dollar amount. It's the, ooh, that was creative. That's something no one else has done. So even if you miss Christmas, it's almost better to give it some random day in January, an unexpected gift and unexpected creativity. So that'd be my little spiel on that.
And if you're not good at that, if you're not good at that listening part or knowing what type of gifts, Mr. Schmooze, it's a great book. It's a quick read that just helps you understand how to appreciate, listen, and make people feel special. And it's just a great book. And if you're on your entrepreneur path when you're beginning, middle, it's something that it'll never be too late in your career to learn how to do better.
There we go. What do we got for housing provider tip of the week?
All right. So housing provider tip of the week. I've been working in maintenance in GC Realty lately, and I'm realizing with all these different technologies around us or automations or services, there's so much more you could do. And this, what I'm about to say, can work for realtors, can work for other property managers, self-managing landlords, but you have all these different services, whether messaging services on demand. So we're using one of them right now for lockboxes. So if I have a listing today, they grab a lockbox for me and they go put it on, and maybe current tenants or the owner, they drop the key in it. So I don't have to drive to the city to do it. And it costs very cheap. So from the suburbs to downtown, it costs like $30. This past weekend, we had a no heat issue with a tenant. And sometimes on the weekend, you just can't fix a no heat. You have to wait till the next morning or something like that. So you got to stock them up with space heaters for the night. And instead of me dragging one of my techs out or doing it myself, I had a message service pick up five space heaters and drive them down to the tenant for like $35. There's all these little things that you could do smarter and more efficient. The other thing, if we, instead of our tech went somewhere the other day and it was a stopper that the tenant needed, instead of sending my technician to the store and then back, he left, went on to the next job, and I basically jumped on Amazon and dropped in the mail a stopper for the tenant, and they'll get it. They can put a stopper in, right? They don't need to have a technician do that. So it's helping my techs be more efficient in their day. It's saving, all that savings gets passed on to our clients in our scenario. But if you're trying to get time back as a self-manager or a realtor trying to be more efficient, these are all these different things out there that you got to make sure you look at. There's a service out there that you could be a realtor and other agents will show for you if you don't want to show your own listings even. So there's all these different little ways to delegate and elevate your time. So keep that in mind.
Yeah, get your time back. Whatever you can do to get your time back, I'm all about. For the past 30 years, and some of you weren't even born 30 years ago, Essex Realty Group has served Chicago's REI market as a top multifamily brokerage. Built on relationships and a commitment to client success, Essex is a cohesive team of experienced brokers ready to help you navigate Chicago's real estate investment landscape. In the past 5 years, Essex has closed over $1 billion in the Chicagoland area. Visit www.essexrealtygroup.com to learn more about their current opportunities, recent transactions, or for a free property valuation. Again, visit essexrealtygroup.com today for all your real estate investment needs. All right, We have a returning guest who does a ton of work. Very excited to have on the show. Huge player in the multifamily space. To give you an idea, we were fact-checking from the bio we had from when he was on about a year ago. He added just a cool $300 million to his portfolio since then. But today's guest, known in the real estate circles as the mad scientist of multifamily, besides being one of the most in-demand speakers in commercial real estate, he's a data guru, a process freak, an outsourcing expert, operates an $875 million portfolio, and treats it as an ongoing experiment in efficiency and optimization. I love that line. The company Grow Capitus has over 4,500 doors and growing. And for those looking to be a passive investor, he's still pumping out deals with great returns. I see them come across my desk almost on a monthly basis, I feel like. He also runs Multifamily U, 5,000 students there. If you haven't checked it out, please do. Just a ton of great content. If you want to learn how to underwrite and analyze multifamily deals, that's the first place I would point you to. I didn't realize this from our first time around, though. Also very into cricket. So, Neil, I learned something new about you. But without further ado, Neil Bowell, welcome back to the show. How are you doing today?
Fantastic. Thanks for having me back on the show, Tom and Mark. It's always a pleasure to be on the Chicago podcast simply because it's one of the cities that I have investments in and I am actually with Mark. He's my property manager, so it's always a delight to be back.
Yes, we are always pumped to have you. So, Mark, do you when someone's looking for their little single family frame home in Roseland and they need a reference, do you hand out Neil's cell phone number?
That's don't you do that to. Mark
so all right, so I want to start. So for those who didn't know, Neil put together real recently a top 10 list. We can link to this in the show notes of just the disruptive trends that are happening in the multifamily space, and some of these are probably easier to guess than others. Hybrid working, architects saw a rise in home gyms, home offices. Mm-hmm. Those were probably what I would call at this point in the game expected, but there's a lot in there, Neil, that was just kind of shocking, for lack of better words. One was your take on retail. Let's start there. What is your take on retail given the data you've analyzed over the past year here and everything that's happened since COVID-19 entered our lives?
Well, the short version is retail is not dead. And most of us have written long obituaries to retail and said, this is going to be a devastating crisis. There's going to be 10 years of short sales and blah, 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 blah. Well, that none of that turned out to be right. And the biggest reason for why retail has not died and is not likely to die is that the value of their land has gone up so fantastically in the last 18 months. So multifamily today in the United States is worth 18% more. Sorry, single family is worth 18% more. And in good areas, in nice areas, the land that is now currently zoned retail and is under these half-occupied properties has actually gone up a great deal in value. It's created a liquidity effect for these retailers. And so what is happening with retail is it's going through a once-in-a-generation shift. We've seen this shift before. If you remember in the 80s, we came in with the new mall, right? So malls were all the rage. People would just go to malls because it was the place to go to. And after a while, it sort of became just passé, right? Young people would still go to malls, but for older people, the charm was gone by the time the 90s had ended. So we've seen that evolution once. And now retail is going through another evolution. And I'm going to give you examples of that evolution, right? So there, everyone's heard of companies like Westfield, right? So they do shopping malls. And you might think that as one of the biggest players in retail right now, they must be having a horrible time. And truth be told, they're not having a good time of it. But they're not doing what most people expect them to do, which is, well, they're going to be like Sears. They're going to be dying for the next 10 years, and eventually one day they will just die. Far from it, they're attracting very large amounts of investor capital from institutional investors. Both Simon and Westfield are attracting large amounts of institutional capital because they have reinvented themselves. And the smaller malls, the strip malls, are going to follow their lead over the next 5 years. Retail is being reinvented. And here's a perfect example of how they're reinventing it. What was the biggest problem with malls? The biggest problem with malls is every customer had to come to a mall. So it was one single source of customers. And if those customers didn't come, then the mall basically looked abandoned, right? Yes. So Westfield and Simon and a bunch of other big mall operators are basically turning the mall concept on its head by building properties like The Domain. So check out The Domain if you're in Austin. It's in North Austin. Gorgeous place. It's an external mall. Right. So there's no internal mall. It's kind of a walk mall. You're walking down the street and you have shops on both sides. What's the biggest benefit of that? air conditioning costs, because heating and cooling costs are killing the mall. Now, when you take people out of that, people are only heating their store, right? They're only heating their shop, and that's their cost. It's being passed on to the company that's in there. So that makes operating a mall much simpler. But the biggest part of it is the domain has three floors of apartments, very high quality apartments above the retail. And they also are anchoring the domain with restaurants on one side. So one, there's a street like filled with restaurants, and then there's a street filled with retail. And then they have on one side of the domain, they have offices. On the other side, they have hotels, right? So this is a live example. Anybody can Google it. You don't need to go to Austin. Just go to Google and check it out. It's a really well-designed, thought-out structure. So now you've got basically the offices giving you lots and lots of customers for retail and also for restaurants during the day. And then you've got thousands of people that come home during the evening and they come down and they're frequenting the restaurant side. Usually by 7 o'clock, the retail's gone. It's closed, right? They close fairly early these days. All retail closes fairly early. But the restaurant strip is just incredibly vibrant. And so what has happened is that because of COVID, almost every city in the US has finally said, fine, we will help you rezone. If you want to go from retail to mixed use, we'll do it. In the past, cities were the obstacle. Simon and Westfield have been trying to go from retail to mixed use for decades. But the problem is zoning, right? Zoning is an issue. And most cities were like, no, we like the money that retail makes a lot more in taxes than multifamily does. Now, at this point, the cities are like, oh, you could simply go out of business. I don't want to have an abandoned mall in the middle of my city. So every city is like, okay, what do you want to do? Okay, well, I want to build another four floors above an existing mall. Okay, I'll give you, you know, approval to do that. You just need to take care of parking. Well, I have plenty of parking. My customer count is down to 50%. So I have 400, 500 parking spots. And parking is one of the biggest costs of having multifamily. So now what's happening is that this reinvention of retail is happening. More and more malls have 24-hour fitness or Apple Fitness in there. So they're making it a destination for people to go to, and they're making it a destination for people to live there. Now, how does this work with strip malls? Well, to some extent it does, and some extent it doesn't. I do predict that we will see significant bankruptcies in the strip mall business over the next 2 or 3 years. So that is still coming. But I think many of them will still be able to get approval to build on top of where they are. The density levels will increase. The problem with strip malls is they don't have enough parking. The big malls all have plenty of parking, so they'll get approvals much faster. With the strip malls, it'll be dependent. Some cities will be like, look, this is going to be a blight. It's going to close. It's going to sit there for the next 5 years. Nobody's going to buy it. Let's help them in some way or the other, right? So what they might do is say, okay, demolish a portion of your retail and then go vertically upwards and build some multifamily. And now you've got some more retail left at the bottom. So a reinvention of retail is happening. I don't see retail dying out. I did see this insane spike that we all saw of e-commerce as soon as COVID opened, right? So for a while, for about 7 or 8 months, e-commerce was straight line growth, right? Straight line growth is the greatest thing in anything in history.
We all know but all then it plateaued off, Amazon right? drivers' names. Like, yeah.
Exactly, right? So, and Bezos, you know, divorces his wife, gives her $40 billion, still the second richest man in the world, right? Straight line growth. It's plateaued out. It's plateaued out. I'm seeing now it's back to its trend of 10%, 15% growth in e-commerce. And people are going back to retail for one big reason. We punished the world by keeping them locked up for 18 months. So now what people are doing is they're, once they're comfortable, it's like revenge retail. It's like, I want to go to a mall, not because I enjoy a mall, but because I can prove that COVID did not kill me. Right? I can get out of the house. So you're actually seeing an upsurge there. Holiday sales are up significantly with retail. Once again, so we're moving from slow-moving debacle to a slow-moving evolution where there's still going to be a little bit of a debacle aspect, but not the meltdown that many people had predicted, including myself, because none of us saw that land that's sitting under the retail becoming so lucrative in an 18-month COVID period.
Yes. You know, I've been following the mall thing for a while. They got the website, they got all the vacant mall tours and all that stuff, abandoned malls. I always watch those, but I've been watching for a long time because I've always known that what everyone's known. This weekend, we were looking for Santa. We went to Spring Hill Mall in Cartersville out here in Dundee. And four of the five department stores are gone and the place is going, as Simon Properties dumped the property a few years ago and it's going fast. But then you have down Westfield, which they own Fox Valley Mall in Aurora. They're building 300 units off of, they tore down the old Carson Ferry Scotts and they're doing exactly what you said and what they have down at the Domain here at the Simon Center. So, and Woodfield's got a whole bunch of plans they're doing with stuff like that as well too, which is also a Simon property. So I love watching kind of how they're trying to take the asset and kind of reinvent it. Now, Oakbrook, for anyone listening, Oakbrook Mall, like they're almost ahead of their time and they've always had the office. They've been an outdoor mall. They've had the office space on the site. So it's out. It's kind of interesting to see how they're kind of too far ahead of their time where the rest are all trying to catch up now. So,
yeah, I think it's a very interesting concept. I think that by having multiple streams of income, the mall, the outdoor mall is much more resilient to shocks than an indoor mall was because it didn't really have these multiple streams of incomes. There's people living at the hotel at the Domain that are coming out and then buying stuff from the restaurants. They're shopping because there's all these fancy stores and people living at this anchor hotel are coming in. So it's a very interesting concept. Now there's another reason why the meltdown is not happening. So I'll give you this final 1 minute nugget and it's Amazon. So far this year, Amazon's bought 25 malls. Now, Amazon's careful not to buy the rich malls. Look, it goes into the areas where the malls are run down, and it basically just turns them into distribution centers because of all the parking and all the other benefits. It can actually extend its space because it needs less parking. So instead of there being these blighted malls throughout the United States, what's happening is the blight is not there because Amazon looks at it and says, oh, cheap mall. I need to put a distribution center everywhere. So they bought 30 so far this year. Their plan is to buy 150 next year, which is great for us because the last thing any city wants is a blighted mall. And in the end, it's like Amazon's almost respectable now. Land values go up when Amazon puts a warehouse in a place. I don't know why they go up because it's not really high end, but they do go up. So cities are like, this is not a net negative. Let's just allow them to take this mall.
It's interesting.
So like going back to Mark's example, one struggling department store is closing, like the path forward there is distribution center. If we're not going to be able to get what we want with the parking.
If it's a great area, the path forward is to go make mixed use and start going vertically with multifamily. If it's not a good area, the path is, look, before we go bankrupt, let's just sell to Amazon and move on.
Got it. All right. And then, so Neil, what about the take your B or C neighborhood that's not a mall, but it's your typical downtown of a little suburb where you have the storefronts and the apartments above? What do you see happening to those, like, call it smaller, 9 units with a storefront in front?
So I think they will do really well because what we are finding, and the guy to read is, what's his name? The big shift ahead guy. His first name is John, consultant, runs a consulting company. I can't remember his last name. So read the book, Big Shifts Ahead. And he talks in that book about the concept of Surban. Surban is a mashup, obviously, of suburban and urban together. And what we are finding is everywhere in the United States where people are trying to build mini urban areas, where there's 3 floors of apartments with retail under, those areas are outperforming traditional strip malls by a factor of 2x to 3x. So we think that as long as it's not like one freestanding building with retail, as long as it's a clump of 4 or 6 or 10, those areas are outperforming. They are not having trouble leasing out their retail. And some of it is still a revolving door. Somebody comes in and rents it for 2 years and somebody else comes in and takes over. But they're not going bankrupt. You know why? 90% of their revenue is in the apartments. So when the retail side is not consistent, they're still not going bankrupt. Those companies are still owning and making money because there was no way that the city would have approved just apartments in that area, right? The cities have restrictions where you can only do mixed use. So even with the retail size underperforming, we are not seeing any delinquencies in those areas because they're kind of sort of making it up on the apartments above.
Got it. And it's John Burns, right?
John Burns. Thank you. Yep. Yes. Yes. Big shifts ahead.
As anyone can see, the real estate market in Chicago is incredibly hot. Homes are being listed and sold in literally a day, and prices are going through the roof. This fact has not gone unnoticed by the Cook County Assessor's Office, who is in the process of reassessing all property in the city of Chicago this year. Property owners in Chicago can expect massive increases in their assessments to reflect the new market values. We're getting a small snapshot of this in Rogers Park, whose assessments just recently came out. Some of my clients saw their assessments double and even triple. So imagine you're paying a tax bill of $4,000. Next year, you could be paying a tax bill as high as $12,000. So what can you do to prevent an increase like this from happening to you? You need to appeal your property tax assessment. I've been doing this for 15 years and saved my clients over $100 million in reduced property taxes by effectively appealing their assessment. Cook County is a complex, multi-layer appeal process with ever-changing rules that can be difficult to handle for the average person. However, I've effectively navigated this process for all types of clients. Single-family homeowners, commercial property owners, industrial property owners, apartment buildings, and community associations. Don't sit on the sidelines. Be proactive, and before this increase impacts your bottom line, give me a call.
All right, so it sounds like you're pretty bullish on retail. Let's talk about the industrial side a little bit too, because coincidentally today I got a Grow Capitis. Hey, we have something 13% cash on cash in the industrial segment here. Are you where are you focusing right now? Are you being industry specific? Are you being geo specific? Where are you focusing? Where are you placing your chips on the table?
So I'm not bullish on retail. I just simply at this point don't believe that there's a debacle coming in that space. I think that retail will underperform significantly. And I think in the long run, the real debacle is in the office space. But it is the slowest debacle you can ever imagine because the average office lease is 5 to 7 years and the average office tenant has hundreds of thousands of dollars in the bank. The average Class C tenant has $400 in the bank. So it's very difficult for companies to default on leases without destroying their credit history. But so it's a very slow, very long term, but extremely powerful debacle that we are going to see in the office space. So back to e-commerce, though, I see no change in that trend line. E-commerce growth is 4 to 5 times the US's population growth, right? Or even more. And then, of course, it went straight line during COVID. And when it came back, it didn't plateau out. It went back to that original trend line. And that trend line is many times faster than the US economy. So I don't see that changing. I think industrial is an incredible market. It's a very hot market. And I think it will continue to outperform for the next 15 to 20 years. Keep in mind that, sure, we had straight line growth for a while. But still, at this point, maybe 13, 14% of all retail in the US is online. So I still think that there's an enormous growth that happens there in the next 15 or 20 years. All those grandmas and grandpas that now have learned how to buy stuff from their iPads are going to keep buying. And younger folks are just growing up knowing that e-commerce is a way to go, which I think it is. It's a more efficient way of doing lots and lots of things. I buy 600 items a year from Amazon. So I believe that you're going to see significant demand in the industrial space. Especially in the industrial is divided into lots of pieces. So the piece that has the roll-up doors and you can bring large trucks in, the fulfillment piece is going to see absolutely astonishing demand for the next 10 years. And in my mind, could slightly outperform multifamily over the next 10 years.
I have to tell you, my wife has you beat on the Amazon purchases, though. I hate to admit that on air, but... But so industrial, though, so it's been going gangbusters for the last decade. And a place like Elk Grove, since we've been doing industrial work there, one of the largest industrial parks in the country, they're like at 2 or 3% vacancy. And they literally tore down an entire residential neighborhood to build a couple big, couple hundred thousand square foot buildings. Is that cap, that ceiling cap, directly correlated with the e-commerce kind of continuing to climb? Like, is there really no ceiling on this industrial side of things? The e-commerce is going to kind of keep growing and people shifting.
Yes, I don't think that there's... So if you look at e-commerce growth forecast for the next 10 years, it's pretty strong. It's pretty robust, right? And it's growing much faster than the US economy. There's an argument to be made that at some point, multifamily has to return to norm because our population growth in the US is slowing, right? So multifamily is a factor of population growth in the end, correct? Because you, obviously, if your population drops, you need less units. But e-commerce is different. E-commerce can grow at twice, 3x, or even 5x the US economy for the next 10 years, and it still wouldn't get to 50% of all retail. Right now, it's at 15. So fundamentally speaking, from a math perspective, from a logic perspective, e-commerce could enjoy a significant ramp, whereas with multifamily, it's going to go up, but there's going to be some plateaus, and there might also be some drops in there, simply because most people have not absorbed the fact that the US's population growth in the last 3 years has slowed to an absolute trickle. And that's not factored into anyone's underwriting that I've ever seen.
While you're mentioning underwriting, I want to ask you this off air, but let's just do it on air here so everyone can hear this as well. When you're looking to do, you're doing a project, it's a 2-year, 3-year stabilization, you're doing some sort of value add component. How are you handling two things? One, the potential interest rate hike. Rates will most likely be higher than what they are today. may or may not be true, but just a safe assumption. And also, what are you doing about cap rate? Because cap rates are so compressed right now. Where do you see them going 24 month, 36 month sort of stabilization?
This is one of my favorite things to talk about because this is a myth that I like to bust. Even folks like you that have hundreds of people on their podcasts have probably never heard this. All right. So I want everyone to understand what I'm about to say because it's so important. I think we brainwash ourselves in a terrible, non-data-driven way around cap rates and interest rates. So if I was to look at the cap rate trend in the United States over the last 10 years, okay, that trend just looks like a downward sloping line. At no point does that line, its downward slope, sharpen or become more shallow. It's just a consistent from 2011 to 2021, a downward slope. And then in 2021, it falls off a cliff, right? Currently, cap rates are declining at the fastest rate in history. But let's say, ignore that last part that I just said. Just look at this slope. It's 10 years. It's very consistent downward slope, right? Now, let's talk about what happened in the middle of that slope. From December 2015 to December 2018, a three-year time frame, the Federal Reserve raised rates 9 times. The Fed funds rate went from 0.25 to 2.50. That's 9 increases. Please show me any point in that three-year time frame when that curve downwards for cap rates even became shallower. I tell you, it's not there because I've shown it to people in large conferences and everyone's shocked. So when people say interest cap rates will go up because of interest rates, they go up. That's not a data-driven statement. That simply is wrong. Here's the right statement. There is a significant correlation between increase in interest rates and increase in cap rates. Here's the second statement that's true. There are many reasons why cap rates go down or go up. Population growth, job growth, income growth, interest from institutional investors, the returns from other asset classes besides real estate all have significant impact on cap rates. And here's the third statement. There is no evidence, statistical evidence, that in the last 10 years, interest rate hikes have had anything to do with cap rates at all. So I'm not saying that there was no impact. I'm saying that there were other factors that were statistically so much more significant that you simply couldn't see the impact of 9 interest rate hikes on decline in cap rates. In the next 2 years, the Fed is likely to raise rates. And you are right. It's very likely that interest rate hikes will happen at this point in time, given how fast inflation is running. I think there's 2 hikes coming in 2022, 2 hikes in 2023. Some people think 3 altogether. I think it's 4 altogether. We've done 9. And we couldn't even affect the slope. Do you think 4 are all of a sudden going to affect the slope, shallow it out, and start making it go up? In the middle of the largest liquidity event in modern history, when $15.5 trillion were pumped into the world economy, the last time we pumped $4 trillion into the world economy, it resulted in a 10-year boom. This time we pumped in 3 times as much on an economy that's only 20% larger than it was 10 years ago. We plugged in 3x the liquidity. But we're expecting that the boom will only last 1 year? I mean, how is this data driven? These things take a long time. It takes a massive amount of time for $15 trillion to get into the economy. And everyone that says, oh no, that's liquidity that the Fed will withdraw, I'd like to prove to you that the Fed will not. In 9 years, the Fed withdrew $360 billion out of the $4 trillion that they pumped into the economy. In 9 years, they didn't get to the 10% mark. Check my facts. These are public numbers. So they withdrew 9% of the liquidity that they injected in 9 years. Yes. It would have taken them 100 years to remove it. Today, there's not even the possibility of that because the world economy and the US economy, we're crack addicts, right? We're addicted to liquidity. The slightest change in liquidity has astonishing knock-on effects into the economy. So really is no chance that a significant portion of this money is going to get removed from the economy. What the Fed is likely to do, what it will do, is it'll stop adding more stimulus. Right now, they're buying $120 billion of bonds. They're going to cut that down. It'll go to 60, then it'll go to 40, then it'll go to 20. One day, it'll be zero. So they won't throw more crack at us. But the crack that's already in the system is 10 years worth of crack for a $68 trillion world economy. Do you understand that?
I understand that. That's
we don't
the title
need
of the
more
episode.
Crack.
10 years
we
of crack.
We got it.
$68 trillion economy. So let's play this through. So I follow exactly what you're saying. I and this is like blowing my mind here. At some point, though, let's say cap rates continue to compress and values continue to go up. At some point, there will be a, we cannot even cover cash flow here, especially if interest rates do go up. Is that, like, that's the only part I'm kind of missing. If some point, if they continue to compress, values are higher.
Sure.
So loans are higher. I guess if you still have growing population, you have the rent increases to offset everything that I'm talking about. Is that?
No, your concern is completely legitimate.
Okay.
To study that, you need to look at other economies. The United States was a unicorn when it came to real estate for the last 25 years. Everything here was weird. Do you know that if you look at 20 other developed economies in the world, and you can just pick one randomly, we're the only one that offers cash flow. The cap rates in most developed economies have been under 3 cap for the last 10 years. In London, cap rates are in the 2s. In Singapore, they're in the 1s. So this concept that you have, Tom, one half of your statement is correct, but the other half is incorrect. The one half of the statement that is correct is cap rates are now falling, and they've already fallen, Tom. Let's be honest here. They've already fallen to the point where there's no cash flow. We're trying to create cash flow through like aggressive rent hikes and rehab programs and things like that. We're trying to push it. There isn't cash flow on the day we buy a property. That's already happened. Right? So the big question, is it sustainable? The answer is, it was sustainable in every other developed nation in the last 10 or 15 years. It's not good news, right? It's not good news that real estate is now entering the point where there isn't substantial cash flow. But something else that hasn't had cash flow for the last 20 years? Stocks. If you buy 100 random stocks, 4 of them will offer dividends. And those dividends will be puny. So all stocks have offered, and they've done a good job of offering, is appreciation. And that's the vast majority of the market. Stocks are a much bigger asset class than real estate. For the longest time, real estate had an extraordinary benefit only in the United States. Why do Canadians buy so much US real estate? Where's their cash flow? Why do Singaporeans buy it? Nobody else in the world really had this unique multifamily structure with 200, 300 units multifamilies. Pick a major European country, try to find a 300 unit property anywhere. They just didn't have it. Other countries have not had cash flow. It hasn't mean real estate has tanked there. It just means real estate doesn't offer cash flow. It just means real estate is not as lucrative. It doesn't mean that it tanks. So we're already there, Tom, right? So this cash flow story is ending. But that doesn't necessarily mean real estate will crash because of it. Because then we'd see real estate crashes happening every few months somewhere in the world.
Got it. That's all blowing my mind. One other thing I want to bring up then with the rent hikes, people keep saying, well, inflation, everything will go up. We can assume these aggressive rent hikes, and maybe in some areas you can because population growth, demand, etc. But in general, if you're in a C class, even call it B class, do you see wages keeping up with inflation? If you're someone making 50 grand a year or whatever, do you see that person's wages will keep up with inflation and everything else? Or is any rental increase going to be more so on you're in the right place where there's demand for your units?
Yes and no. So I'm going to give you a yes and no answer, right? So if rents continue increasing at the maddening 12% level that we've seen in the last 12 months, 12%? Yeah, that makes no sense at all. Obviously, it has to stop, right? That is non-sustainable. But let's talk about a 6% rent increase. Right? Most people are like, salaries don't go up 6% in the US. Therefore, 6% rents are unsustainable. That is another non-data-driven statement. The only way for me to prove it to you that 6% rents are in fact sustainable in a 3% salary increase environment is to give you an example straightforward. Okay. So Mark has some tenants. They live in Chicago. And it's a family of 4 people. And they're lower middle class. They live in on the south side. And they make $60,000. So husband and wife working, they make 60 grand a year. With me so far, right? Yep. And they have 2 kids. And they live in a property that Mark has. It's one of those Southside flats. And the rents, even though the rents are higher now, I'm just going to use $1,000 because it's an easy example. So they're paying Mark $1,000 a month for this property, right? Now, this year, their salary goes up 4%. Inflation is very high right now. So 4% increase in income are not unusual. 4% of 60 grand is $2,400. Now, what most people assume is that, oh, yeah, but only like 20 or 30% of that can go towards rent. No. John Burns says, and a lot of economists say, that today people are putting 50 to 60% of their increases in income towards their rent. What is the rest going for? Food. So almost all of the money that we're making at this point that have made in the last few years is going towards food, gas, and rent. None of it is going towards making people have a higher quality of life or going to more movies or going to more vacations. So now let's talk about this $2,400. Let's assume that 50% of that is going towards rents, right? That's $1,200. Now think about it. Mark was charging $1,000 a month for a unit. If $1,200, 50% of this $2,400 that this family makes goes towards rent, Mark can increase rents by 10% from 1,000 to 1,100. Now, of course, my example is somewhat self-serving. In the long run, though, I think it's fair to say that people can make a 4% increase in their salary actually equates to somewhere around a 6 or 7% increase in rent that is sustainable. Now let's back off on the salary increases. In an environment where there's a 3% increase in salaries, you can usually sustain a 5% increase in rent, not a 3%. But you never hear about this in a podcast because everyone assumes 3% increases in salary equals 3% increase in rent. No, look at the allocation, right? Every dollar that comes in, 50% of it is going to rent increases. Therefore, 3% salary increases actually equate to 5% rent increases. And that's what's sustainable. It's horrible news for the US because quality of living is going down because every dollar that's coming in is basically just going towards rent, food, and gas. But it's also the truth.
Man, there's a lot there. So I want to stay on that thread now because, and you brought up John Burns again. So even like, pre-COVID, I remember his thoughts, and you correct me if I'm wrong, you're more in tune than I am on this, but with millennials who saw their parents get beat up in the financial crisis, with affordability becoming harder, he was saying, we're going to get to a point where there's an obnoxious amount of renters compared to homeowners. I don't remember the facts or the numbers, but it was, we're trending that way, and you're seeing it in other places now. Do you see it, especially with interest rates going up, do you see that also being the case, the renter pool becomes higher than it is in current state today with everything that you just
no doubt about it. I mean, so his original arguments have not changed. I think that they were valid when he made them. Of course, the book is 5 years out of date, so he really needs to write bigger shifts ahead, right? So I think today, if he was doing it, he would say, look, my original assumptions are still valid. The one thing that's changed is COVID has made people want to own a home more. It's become more important to them. But the counterbalance to that is US homes are now 18% more expensive than they were a year ago. And in some parts of the US, as much as 40%, right? Austin went up 44% in the last year. Boise went up about 35%. So in some parts of the US, they're really expensive. And that prevents people from going from being renters to becoming homeowners. In 10 years, I expect 3D printing to completely change the paradigm. But in the meantime, I do expect that the percentage of owners versus renters will continue to shift in favor of rentership. I'll just say it'll go that direction for perhaps 4 to 5 years, and then things will change. Technology will bring change to real estate.
Got it. All right. So you mentioned 3D printing, but I wanted to ask before we jump there, let's talk about tokenization, because that's another one in the presentation that you had that was eye-opening to me. It's something I never even thought about. So you talk about tokenization having just dramatic effects over the next 5-10 years in real estate.
That's
right. The floor is yours. Go to town here.
So it's 1,000 times less efficient to buy a single-family rental property and get it ready for a renter than it is to buy Apple stock. It takes roughly 5 minutes to pick up your phone, tap, open the app, and go in and buy Apple stock. 5 minutes. And I would say it takes at least 5,000 minutes to buy a rental property and get it ready for a tenant. Today, most properties, you have to, if you want to make profit, you have to buy properties that are not in the right shape. So you have to do your research. You have to figure out the cities. You have to call people like Mark Ainley. You have to figure out where you're going. You fly to that city the first time, the second time, make a bid, lose a bid, make another bid, lose a bid, blah, 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 blah. Eventually get a property, then start your rehab process, then take months to do this. I think I'm being extraordinarily generous when I say that it takes 5,000 minutes to buy and rent a property as compared to 5 minutes to buy Apple stock. So the biggest advantage and the biggest disadvantage of real estate are the same. Real estate is very work intensive and patience intensive. People who are patient do better in real estate, where people that just want to buy a tap stock don't do well in real estate. It's also the biggest benefit of real estate because there's so many people unwilling to do that work that real estate has always got a premium. That's why over the last 10 or 15 years, over any 10, 15 year timeframe, real estate beats stocks in terms of overall returns, correct? That's about to change for better and for worse. So tokenization is the process of turning real estate into stock. I come on a webinar, I talk with Mark, and Mark's like, what's your favorite cities in the US to invest in? And I say, well, it's Idaho Falls and Dalton, Georgia and Destin, Florida. And I give him a bunch of these cities that nobody's ever heard of, and I explain my reasons. And so now someone's listening to that podcast. It is my assumption that within 5 years, people listening to Mark's podcast are going to come in, tap on their phone, find a different app. It wouldn't be called Robinhood or E-Trade. It'll be called something different, right? And in that app, he'll type in the name of Idaho Falls. He's never heard of Idaho Falls, but Neil Bawa thinks it's a great place to invest in. Therefore, I'm going to go out there. And he's going to go to Idaho Falls. And then on his screen, he's going to see a bunch of properties, single family, residential, retail, hotels, all kinds of properties will be listed. And he will be able to buy not a certain stock price, but a token. And that token will cost $50 or $100. Those are the most common two prices of tokens. And you'll be able to say, yeah, I like single family real estate in Idaho Falls. So I see this property, I see the cash flow. I'm going to go in, I'm going to invest $5,000 into this property. And now the infrastructure to make sure that $5,000 actually goes to the owner of that property and rents from that owner are distributed back out to this person without that person ever having to lift a finger. That infrastructure, that process, the technology, the backends, the legalities is called tokenization. And it will change the way we do real estate. It's bad news in the long run for people like Tom Shallcross and Mark Ainley and Neil Bawa, because we are the in-between people. We make money from the in-between process of real estate management, right? But in the short run, over the next 5 years, it also means that cap rates for all kinds of real estate will drop. Anytime an asset becomes commoditized, whether that's stock, whether that's Bitcoin, whether that's NFTs, the moment it becomes very easy to buy a particular asset class, its prices skyrocket. I'm expecting that as we tokenize all of real estate in the US, 5 years from now, a parking lot in Manhattan that makes money will be visible on a tokenization app, and you can invest there if you think that traffic is going to get worse in Manhattan. That's where we are going to end up in 5 years. It's a process. And most people are like, yes, but this is not really happening. He's talking about, I'm not talking about crowdfunding. Sure, crowdfunding has existed for the last 6 years, but less than 1% of the United States invests through crowdfunding portals because of lots of different reasons, you're a credit investor, all that, blah, 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 right? This is the concept of basically having an app where hundreds of thousands of different types of properties are in there, Airbnb properties are in there. You just choose to invest in whatever catches your fancy and your paradigm. That's where we end up in 5 to 10 years. In 5 years, we'll be there. In 10 years, that is the primary way in which people will buy real estate. So during that time, I do expect it to make a significant upward dent in the prices of real estate. But in the long run, it puts Mark Ainley and Neil Bawa out of business unless we evolve during those 10 years to be in charge of those kinds of apps. And anybody that thinks that won't happen, just Walmart, Amazon, how many thousands or tens of thousands of in-between brokers did Amazon and Walmart put out of business? Is there any reason it wouldn't happen with real estate? I can't think of one.
So who are the people that are leading the charge to tokenize? who are the people that run the big organizations that are doing this and creating these type of services? Is this the Blackstones? Is this backed by Wall Street? I mean, who's the people that are behind the scenes putting this together for us to come and hit our phone and buy a $5,000 share in Idaho?
So there's buckets, right? So you already hit two out of three. There's Wall Street, right? So you've got Wall Street that's basically saying tokenization is the next trend. Why does Wall Street like tokenization? Because they think of it as stock. And they make all their money from stocks. So Wall Street's pushing really hard. And then you've got the big funds like, you know, Blackstone that are looking to basically make equity investments into companies. The third group is venture capital. Venture capital right now is extremely hot for both the front end and the back end of tokenization, right? The back end is more powerful, but the front end, I'll give you an example. You can today go to lofty.ai, lofty.ai, go in there. And you'll see a bunch of properties listed. Some are duplexes, some are triplexes, some are single family. And you'll notice there's a button. You click on it and you can buy tokens. So it's this concept that this isn't here yet is silly. People don't know about it here yet. It doesn't mean it's not here. You can buy $50,000 worth of real estate from lofty.ai in the next 3 minutes, right? That's how simple it is. It's already here. And that's a front end company. The backend companies are the ones that are basically allowing Lofty.ai to not have to deal with the tokens, because Lofty doesn't deal with the tokens, are dealt with on the blockchain. There's backend stuff happening to make sure that there are not too many tokens, too few tokens. There's backend stuff that's happening to make sure that rents are being distributed and sliced out and Mark gets his $50 worth of rents. And so front end and backend companies are working on it. Altogether, there's over 200 companies working on it. Roughly 5 will succeed. Everybody else will die.
Yeah, Lofty's buying in Chicago. We actually managed a couple of units from as of the last couple of weeks, and they're stuff more. So I learned a whole bunch about them in the last week. So it's ironic you said that.
Right. It's just one example, right? So there's dozens of front end companies trying to do what Lofty is doing. And some of them are not even interested in single family. They're doing multifamilies. There's one group that's only doing hotels, right? So they're a hotel group. And so they basically opened up this concept of, hey, we're a $1 billion hotel group. Why don't we build a website where we'll sell hotels by the token? So far, they seem to be doing all right.
One more note on Lofty. I went on to it. Cool little user experience here. They say how many tokens are left. I've never seen these properties. I already have FOMO, though. There's only like 200 tokens.
There's incredible FOMO on their websites. Like, we only have 7% of tokens left. Click, 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 click.
Yeah,
right? It's just, it's insane that will happen. And again, they are already raising. Lofty is now responsible for increasing prices of single family real estate in Cincinnati and Cleveland because they're buying and loftizing a property at least once a week, sometimes 3 times a week. Right? And they're just a year old company. Imagine where they go from here. Right? So here's a prediction. In 5 years, you'll be able to buy tokens on Amazon. Why would the biggest e-commerce player in the United States stay out of this market? It makes no sense. Right? And there'll probably be middlemen. I don't think Amazon will go around buying properties. But they have the biggest e-commerce platform in the world.
Will there ever be any, in your opinion, or maybe any sort of regulation around this? SEC type stuff like that oversees a company like Lofty, or is there already, I guess? Let me ask that question.
So here's my answer. And this is a prediction. It's also a speculation. People are like, what Lofty is doing is illegal. It can't really happen. There's, you know, SEC violations, blah, blah, blah. Here's my prediction. And I'm not suggesting that this will happen to Lofty. It's just an overall prediction. How does change take place in the United States today? All change in the US takes place because somebody does something wrong that they're not supposed to do. The first one that does it gets beaten up and shut down. The second one that does it gets beaten up and shut down. The third one, by the third time, they're like, God, people are going to do this anyway. Let's write some goddamn regulations. And so the third one basically gets to benefit from the first two that get shut down and some regs are written. And then they make another mistake. And then this time they get fined or curtailed. All regulations in the US today are in response to violations. Over the next 2 or 3 years, all the regs will get written.
See, be a pioneer, but not the pioneer.
You don't want to be the very first in an area that's, you know, blatantly illegal.
Still,
because
the first,
yeah,
nice
you're probably going to pave the way for somebody else, right?
Yeah. So if you're flipping on a block, you want another comp there first. You don't want to be the first guy.
Exactly.
Same.
Exactly.
Hamster.
So it definitely will happen. So the honest answer, Mark, is that it's all gray areas when it comes to legislation. It's going to get worked out in the next 3 to 5 years because that is the nature of this. If too many people start doing stuff, laws get written.
Neil, I know we're pushing up against time, but 3D printing, let's touch on that real quickly because I think that's another fantastic topic.
There is no way that 10 years from now or 12 years from now, you will want to live in the sort of home you live in today. 3D printing started being extremely unattractive because essentially you've got a printer that is printing concrete, right? And it's printing it in layers and going up the walls. And so far, they're basically doing foundations and walls. They haven't figured out how to do roofs. I don't even think that they'll figure it out how to do roofs in the next 10 years. But obviously, it saves an enormous amount of time. But what I am starting to see in 3D printing in the last 12 months that's really exciting is that we're going to go beyond walls. So walls in the United States, and this is not the case in Asia, by the way, where they make beautiful homes. We're the shittiest in the world amongst the developed world when it comes to walls. Because all we know is we know how to do stucco. We know how to do drywall. And so every wall looks really ugly and every wall looks really rectangular. Why do they have to be rectangular? Why can't walls be curved? Why can't walls have patterns and shapes? Because it costs a great deal of money to do that. Nobody wants to do it, correct?
Yep.
But what if you had 3D printing? It doesn't cost anymore for your walls to have curved, beautiful patterns. It doesn't cost anymore for a shelf to come out of a wall. So when and also doesn't cost anymore. Remember how black and white printers in the 80s used to be less expensive than color inkjet printers, right?
Yep,
a 3D printer is simply an inkjet printer that extrudes, throws out concrete, right? What's to prevent them from blending color in over time? So in 10 to 15 years, when you buy an average starter home in the United States, it's going to be a lot cheaper because 3D printing is much faster. It takes a couple of weeks or less to print a home. And more importantly, it'll be massively more attractive at no additional cost. We only make square, you know, and rectangular homes because they're the easiest to make now. But from what I can see, it makes no difference what the shape is for 3D printing. Think about ceiling. Almost every, unless it's a luxury home, we only print flat ceilings in the US. Why don't we have the kind of ceilings that we see in India or in Asia where they're louvered, they've got different levels to them, they've got LED lighting behind them. We don't do it because it's cost. But when a 3D printer is printing a ceiling, would be the same cost. It's just printing something that's a different pattern. So the 3D printing is the largest revolution in real estate. It's not tokenization, because tokenization simply democratizes real estate. It makes it easy to own real estate. What 3D printing does is it makes it cheaper, right?
What is that?
Real estate hasn't gone cheaper in 50, well, significant drop. I think that the honest answer is a plateau followed by a significant drop. I see it coming. Best guess, this is a guess, obviously, somewhere in the 2028 to 2031 timeframe when it becomes very obvious that people would only want to live in 3D printed homes. Now, of course, it's not universal. It's not going to be everywhere. California doesn't allow the use of concrete because of earthquakes. So I think that economy is better protected. But anywhere where you don't have earthquakes, where concrete is pretty common, I think you'll see some incredible revolutions happening in the next 10 years in 3D printing.
And you see it across the board, single family, multifamily?
I think so. I think it affects everything. I think it may affect multifamily more than single family for one simple reason. With single family, you've got momentum. You've still got people creatively building a home, so the market will adapt. Multifamily, come on. It's just a box. Right yeah. now, a class A multifamily is just a 9-foot ceiling box compared to an 8-foot ceiling box. So it becomes very difficult for non-3D printed apartments to compete with beautiful 3D printed apartments in 2031. So I do think that multifamily will get affected faster than single family.
Nice. We'll have to link. There's a couple of cool videos online of showing actual right. houses being printed. So we'll have
to especially the one in Austin. So right now, yeah. the biggest, everyone, every institutional player in the US is watching that 100 home Austin property, because this is the first time where 3D printed homes are being built on prime land, right? This is not some 20 miles from a city. It's right in the middle of Austin and everyone is watching. I'm just as curious as anyone else to see what these homes sell for.
Yeah.
But they've even figured out how to make the concrete look beautiful. I mean, it's just amazing to see this happen in a city like Austin.
Yeah, no, we'll link to that for sure. So, all right, we'll wrap up here. We'll head to a wrap now. We've asked you these questions before. Some of them, based on timing, it might be different. I'll ask my first question a little different. So What makes you different? How have you been able to accomplish what you want to accomplish in life? Or how are you able to get on here and spit out so much knowledge to everybody? What makes you so good?
I'm different. I'm different because I'm different. That's the honest answer to that question. I strive to be different. I strive to be unique. When I buy value-add properties, I buy super value-add. What does that mean? I look for properties that are zoned for more units and I go build extra units. Super value-add. When I do new construction, I look for specific uniquenesses that give me edges. I'm obsessed about being different. And that makes me different by default.
Yeah, that's a different answer. I like it.
All right. So, Neil, we got a ton of people looking to buy their first property or their second property. What is the one piece of advice you would tell them? With everything you just mentioned on the show going on, do you still think buying that 3-unit, house hacking it, is that still a good way to go?
House hacking is always a great thing to do. Not everyone can do it, but I think it makes all the sense in the world to do house hacking. It generally makes sense to be in real estate. All I can tell you is that there's some very adverse winds coming for real estate in the 3 to 4 year timeframe. So there's good news coming like tokenization, and then there's bad news coming like a abrupt slowing of the US population. So which of those two is going to win? I don't know. 3D printing is too far out, so nobody should really think about it. Just keep an eye on it. I don't think it happens in bulk until 2028, and that's too far out. So my feeling is it's still a good time to get into real estate in general. I just want Tom Shallcross to understand that there is no law preventing cap rates from going into the twos. Most of the world is already there. We're just joining them, Tom.
All right. Post-COVID, what do you do for fun?
I improve my home. So I've now improved about 400 areas of my home, and it's taken me about 2 years. And so I'm basically indulging in an experiment where I refuse to go out and buy a brand new home that costs millions because it's contemporary. I'm taking an existing normal property, it's about 3,300 square feet, and making it outrageously contemporary. So I'm almost done.
Oh, that's awesome.
You must travel a decent amount because you don't want to live through that entire thing, right?
I love to travel. I'm still irritated about COVID restricting my travel, but I have to say it's changed my life. I don't think I'm ever going to travel as much as I do. In fact, I haven't been to a conference, though I've been invited to about 20 of them this year. And I could have gone, right? I was vaccinated in January, so I could have gone. And I've chosen not to. So basically, 2021 was my last year of conferences. 2022 is my last year of podcasts.
All right. Well, we got you twice. We'll have to get you back for the 3 times.
Maybe one more time before I say goodbye.
All right. So you already mentioned big shifts ahead, but besides that, name a good book, podcast, or self-development activity that you would recommend to our listeners.
I think the most important one is The Miracle Morning, even though it's not the best. Because The Miracle Morning allows you to find your best book. There is no best book. Everyone has their own. But The Miracle Morning allows you to find it. If you just do The Miracle Morning for even 6 months, and that's a very short amount of time, I've been on it for years, you will find your best book.
I like that. Besides yourself, name one person in your local network, maybe anyone you might know in Chicago that you'd highly recommend to other investors, a quality resource or another speaker or something.
Mark Ainley.
You can't use me. I appreciate that.
Chicago doesn't necessarily work for me in that case. I think that I'll go for Dugan Kelly. He's a fantastic syndication lawyer. One of the best I've ever seen. Very humble, easy to work with for those that are looking to syndicate single family or multifamily. I think Dugan Kelly is pretty awesome. He's also easy to find on the web.
Awesome. Love it.
Neil, thank you so much. You have provided a ton of value. Just my mind is still spinning here a little bit. How can our listeners learn more about you? Is there any way they can provide value to you?
Yes, connect with me. That provides value by default. It's very easy to connect with me. I'm the only Neil Bawa on the World Wide Web. So just simply Google N-E-A-L space B-A-W-A, hit enter. You'll see all kinds of stuff. You'll find your way to me.
Awesome. Mark, it's been a great show. Let's see if we can get the facts here. So right. we talked about the industrial sector a little, so this one will work. So Chicago's industrial market continues to see record levels of demand this year. An astonishing 28.1 million square feet of space was absorbed over the past year. That is 25% higher than the previous record high, which was set in what year? And I'll give you multiple choice. So the previous high before 2021 in the industrial space for absorption, 2004, 2006, 2012, or 2020?
I'll probably just say 2020.
Neil, you want to take a shot at this?
I'll probably say 2020.
2006. I'm sorry, 2004.
My first gut one is in 2004 because they had a lot of, they built a lot in 2000, 2004.
All right, we'll get the next one.
All right, I like it. I like it. All right, Neil, man, thanks for coming back. It was an awesome show. Man, this, I can't wait to listen to the show again because there's so much good stuff to think about. I actually typed in, Tom asked me if I had a question, and I typed in a little chat. I said, I'm processing. So you gave us a lot to think about.
I have no idea how to underwrite right now. The world's going to end. The cap rates are going to 2. I don't know what to do.
So, but thank you so much, Tom, as always. Listeners, please leave us a review. If you're going to leave a 5-star review, of course. And please reach out to us if you know any great guests or anyone that you think would be good for our investor stories. We're still putting investor stories out. We've actually taken a couple of recent investor stories. We turned them into podcast episodes, which have been great learning tools for a lot of you. So thank you, everyone. Tom, Neil, thank you again. And we'll see you soon.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Neil. And if you're interested in the first episode, it was episode 26.
Yes.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guests. They do not reflect the views and opinions of Now Serving Properties, LLC and GC Realty Development, LLC.